So this is our last class, and I'll do a little review in a moment. And I wanted to remind you that when we're studying, deep philosophical topics like this one, chapter 9, it's really important not to get frustrated. It's really important to not feel that you're a loser because you don't get it. None of us get it. If we got it, we'd just be happy all the time. So I've been thinking in my own life recently about just kind of realizing something about my own personality. And that's the abhorrence I have, and probably I've had for many decades now, the abhorrence I have of incompetency in myself and to some extent in others too. incompetency, like just doing a shoddy job or not knowing how to do something. And, of course, all of us don't know how to do a lot of things. And sometimes we can fool ourselves in thinking that we're more competent than we really are. When Cindy and I moved 5 years ago to the country, both of us had always lived in cities our whole lives. And moving out to the country where there's no superintendent to call, if the electricity doesn't work, you don't just pick up the phone and say, come and fix my electricity. There's one electrician in the whole town. There's one there's one of everything in our town. We're fortunate in that way. But, we realized rather quickly how we didn't know how anything worked. Didn't know how plumbing worked. Didn't know how electricity worked. Didn't know how to do anything. Didn't know how to... Yeah, that's right. The things we knew were useless in that situation. And, I felt very incompetent. And still do. 5 years have gone by, we've learned how to do a few things, but not nearly the skill sets that people who've lived their whole lives in the country have. I mean, it's quite amazing that people who don't have other people that they can rely on, when they're living out in the thousands of acres all by themselves, they have to figure out how to fix their lives. Once things break down, they have to learn how to fix them. And that sense of incompetency, then I started thinking back about other examples of that in my life. And I remember when I was first ordained as a monk, the hardest thing about it was that I couldn't dress myself. Those robes are hard to put on. There's a trick to it and all like that. And it was like weeks before I could figure out how to do it right. And it was like being thrown back to being a child again, not being able to put on your own clothes. And so the point of this is that when it comes to the spiritual life, we're all incompetent. It's not just, incompetence like when it comes to understanding the philosophy of emptiness and interdependence and all like that. We're incompetent in general. That's why we have to practice. If we were competent when it comes to a spiritual life, we would be enlightened. That's the definition of competence. And so all unenlightened beings are by definition incompetent. And so we just live with that, The spiritual life is a series of failures. It's not like once in a while you make some small, progress. Some minor little success, but over and over again we fail. We learn about these ideals of how to live a compassionate, good life, ethical life, caring about other people, thinking about other people as ourselves, and we fail over and over and over again. And that's just the way it is. And so we have to, if we're going to persevere, we have to just accept incompetency, and just say, and it's not just you. We're all that way, okay? So, the great universality, the great democracy of incompetency when it comes to a spiritual life. So don't be discouraged, I don't know how many of you know much about American baseball, but I think this is the case in other sports too, you know, football and so forth, that a really good player succeeds like just once in a while. You know, in baseball, they have what they call a batting average, which is like how many times you hit the ball and successfully get on base. And an excellent hitter, a really excellent, you know, star, one out of three times. And this is the major leagues, of course. You know, like, these are the best players in the world. And then the average is more like one in four. Of 250 batting average. And you know, you can make a living in the major leagues succeeding one in four times in baseball. And I think the batting average for a spiritual practitioner is less than that. So don't be discouraged, you know. It's hard. It's hard to overcome old habits. It's hard to overcome at least this lifetime worth of habits, you know. Who knows about past lifetimes, but at least this lifetime, over and over again for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, we've been making the same mistakes over and over again. And then we come to a spiritual life and we say, okay, well, I'll try a different way. And so we have to overcome, you know, huge habits, a huge mountain of habits, and little by little try to establish new habits. And that takes time. It takes time and it takes effort. It takes perseverance. And so don't be discouraged. We're all in the same boat here. And that also, of course, very much pertains to trying to understand what the hell Shantideva is talking about in the ninth chapter. You know, it's not easy. It's not easy at all, and it takes repeated effort over and over and over again. So, you know, some of you, I think, maybe are hearing this kind of thing maybe for the first time. Others of you are hearing it for the 10th time. Others of you are hearing it for the 100th time. And, you know, we're all failures. We're all incompetent. So over and over again, we try. And you know, when you fall off the horse, you try to just get back onto it. Thank you so much. And you get back on and you try again. You try again, you try again. So don't be discouraged and don't be frustrated. This is difficult. This is probably more difficult than living an ethical life, you know? Living an ethical life means, you know, it's not that hard to understand, right? For one thing. Just be nice to people. And then you fight your own, like, inclinations not to be nice to people. It's not hard to understand. But when it comes to like probing the depths of reality, you know, there's larger obstacles in a way. It's not just trying to put it into practice. It's trying to understand what to put into practice. Yeah, you know. So just a quick review. The ninth chapter begins with a statement. Two statements really. That it's really worth trying to get some wisdom. Everything kind of turns on it. I mean, you know, we can make progress in life, learn how to live a little bit happier life by practicing our ethics, by practicing compassion, by learning, you know, how to equalize and, you know, at least theoretically, and then try to put it into practice, equalize and exchanging self for others. But the real prize comes from wisdom. And you know, we all have a shot at the real prize. There's nobody who has a better opportunity than us. And I would say that not just in our present time and place, but in history also. We have enormous advantages that most people, you know, 95-98% of the world's population even now doesn't have, and let alone in previous times. You know, the money, the time, the most importantly, the access to teachings, the literacy that we just assume, you know, knowing how to read, knowing how to think. You know, in past times, some people, you know, became literate. But they didn't really know how to analyze, you know. They just copied or repeated, you know. And the Eastern traditions tended to be memorization and just like reciting stuff that they learned by heart. And in Western traditions, it used to be just like copying out manuscripts, word by word, to preserve the, you know, to preserve the books, but not much attention to actually analyzing what those words were saying, what they were meaning in either case, East or West. So we take that for granted. We're taught this in school. We're taught it in our schools of how to not just how to read, but how to think about what we're reading. How to analyze it, how to evaluate it, how to interpret it in our own lives and so forth. So it's amazing. It's an amazing time to be born in, amazing time and place to be born in. So that has always helped me a little bit to think about discouragement. Because imagine what it would have been like, you know, without those conditions, without those circumstances. How discouraging would that be? You know, and in the past, people, especially in the Eastern traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc., you know, they were just hoping for a better rebirth. This whole life was just, you know, to try to climb up the ladder a little bit. And I suggest to you that the kind of rebirth that they were hoping for, and the kind of rebirth that billions of people, you know, are hoping for even in this life, is the kind of rebirth that we have. You know. We live in the Pure Land. We have been born in the Pure Land. And if you don't believe me, like, you know, interview somebody who's living in a cardboard box on the streets of Mumbai. And, you know, wouldn't take too long as you describe your life to them to say, well, you know, for them to say, well, yeah, you're in the Pure Land. You know, you got it. So we have an amazing opportunity, and we should try to take advantage of it, knowing that we will be failing a lot, even with the great opportunities that we have. You see, we'll be failing a lot, and not to be discouraged, and certainly not to take the Dharma as an excuse to feel low self-esteem. Oh, I don't understand the ninth chapter. I'm such a loser. I'm such a bad person. Other people obviously understand it so much. But not me. And you know what? Other people don't understand it so much.
Thank you.
So that was the first thing that Shanti Deva says, is it really important to try. Try to get some wisdom. And then secondly, he says, wisdom comes in two forms. It's wisdom about deceptive reality, and it's wisdom about ultimate reality. Two truths about reality. And deceptive reality means the reality that we live in, the reality of appearances. And that reality is deceptive because it exists in a way differently than the way we ordinarily see it. We ordinarily see things as if they had some kind of independent self-existence. And they do not exist that way. They exist interdependently and only interdependently, and that includes us too. We only, as people, only exist interdependently with all other people and with all other, with everything in the world, with all experience also. So it's not that deceptive reality is fake or something like that. It's real. The world that we live in is real. It has a reality to it. But the wisdom part comes from when we try to penetrate the illusion of how it seems to exist and get at least some kind of intellectual clarity on how it cannot exist the way it appears. It cannot exist the way it appears. And then ultimate reality. And ultimate reality is not different. It's not a different reality from deceptive reality. It is the negative way of talking about the positive aspects of interdependence. Everything exists interdependently in deceptive reality. And it does not exist in any other way than that. So ultimate reality really is subtracting. It is the absence. It is the absence of something. Okay? So we'll get to verses that emphasize this in this class. That emptiness is not something. Emptiness is the absence of something. Okay? And that just means that there is an absence of things that we think are there in deceptive reality. There's an absence of things that we think are there. There's an absence of permanence. There's an absence of the unchangingness. There's an absence of wholes, W-H-O-L-E, right? These things are not there in the deceptive reality itself, you see. We are deceived by thinking that our conceptualization, our thoughts about deceptive reality are accurate to deceptive reality. So they're just two sides of the same coin. Then Shantideva goes into the necessity, how necessary it is to try to understand emptiness. If we want to stop our suffering, I mean, like, in a big way, we can reduce our suffering. I think pretty much everyone in this room knows this from personal experience, that if you start living a better life, you know, start living a good life, that you won't suffer so much. You know, you get along with people better. When the ups and downs, the vicissitudes of life occur, which they always will, the ups and downs, you're able to be more even keeled about it, more even about it. You know, well, that comes from practice, getting in control to some extent, at least, of your own mind through meditation, of your own body through yoga. You know, these kinds of things work. These kinds of things bring a better life. But not the goal, not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal comes from really penetrating the illusion that we live under, really penetrating through the layers and layers and layers and layers, and they are many, of ignorance, and to try to get to it. So that's, you know, Shantideva's like, you know, advertisement for really trying when it comes to this difficult material. And then he goes into depth. He goes into depth about using reason, using logic, analytical wisdom, to try to get us clear in our minds that the way things appear cannot be the way they are. They are empty. So he talks about two kinds of emptiness. There's really only one kind, but emptiness is applied to two different things. Emptiness of self and emptiness of phenomena. Emptiness of me, emptiness of mine. Emptiness of the person and emptiness of things. It's just, all these are just two different ways of talking about the same two kinds of emptiness, two applications, you could say, of emptiness. So there's no self. There's no me. Why? Can't find it. Can't find it in the body. Can't find it in the mind. A me that could exist in an unchanging way, a me that could exist in a unitary way, or a me that could exist independent of the mind and body. So the mind and body are made up of multiple and changing parts. So where's the unchanging and unitary self if it's locatable somewhere in the mind-body complex, which is made up of many parts, all of which are changing all the time? Can't be there. So the only other option is to say, well, it is independent of the body-mind complex. And that's impossible too, right? There's no self that can be removed from the body-mind complex. You know, that's when we talk about ourselves, we assume that we have a body and we have a mind. So the self is unfindable. Then he turns to the emptiness of phenomena, the emptiness of things. And he says there's no holes, W-H-O-L-E. There's no holes. Holes are just ideas overlaid on a set of parts, right? That's the case with everything. Everything can be analyzed into its parts. Your body can be analyzed into its parts, and then we say body. On the basis of the parts of the body, we say body. But there's no body, just an idea of the body, right? Right? It's just like the battalion, the army battalion. This is, army battalion's just made up of whatever the hell, soldiers. You know, and then on, yeah, soldiers, and then you say battalion. And then you look at soldiers, or you look at the parts of the body. Are they made up of parts? And of course they are. Every part of the body can be reduced to its parts. And down you go. There's no partless part in anything physical. No partless part. And then you can also do that. He doesn't do it so much in this chapter, maybe not at all, actually. But you, in other treatments, you can say the same is true of time. Of time. So, you know, what, an hour is made up of 60 minutes. And 60 minutes is made up of, and every minute is made up of 60 seconds. And every second is made up of a hundredth of a second, a hundredths of, and down you go. There's no partless part of time either. There's no moment in time that can't be further reduced to subversions, subdivisions of that moment. Every beginning, a moment has a beginning, middle, and end, right? There's a beginning of a, that's what a moment means. A moment starts, lasts a moment, and then stops. And then you say, well, does the beginning of any moment have a beginning, middle, and end? You say, well, sure, it must, right? Every beginning of a moment must itself have a beginning, middle, and end. What about the beginning of a moment? Does it have a beginning, middle, and end? And down you go. See, it can't be happening out there. Time can't be happening out there. Space can't be happening out there. It has to be coming from us in a sense, okay? Of course, the us that it's coming from also isn't there all by itself. You know, he already talked about that, right? The emptiness of self. So everything exists only in a dreamlike fashion. Only in a dreamlike fashion. There is no object without a subject. There is no subject without an object. That's interdependence. Neither can exist without the other. And neither can come from us. Yeah. And, you know, I say that over and over again because it's been very helpful to me to try to get a handle on, you know, on what can be talked about in a very complex way, as Shantideva's doing. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why there are Shantidevas in the world and Nagarjunas in the world is because, you know, people like us who have a great deal of reliance on the intellect just aren't satisfied with, like, simple formulas. So, no, it's got to be more complicated than that. So I'm going to write a whole ninth chapter on how complicated it can be so that people like us can sit around going, you know, and feel like at the end of the ninth chapter we've done some work. But you don't, in a way, you don't have to do that much work. You have to do the work in order to convince yourself, you see. If you could convince yourself with just that formula that I keep reciting, no X without Y, no Y without X, neither can exist without the other, neither can come first. Well, great. If you can convince yourself with just that, that's fine. But most of us say, oh, I want it more complicated than that. Please, could you please complicate it more? Okay. So that's a little bit of a summary. We'll move on. I thought these next verses I'll kind of do very quickly because these are verses in relation to the Sankhya school. Sankhya. Sankhya means counting, actually, enumeration in Sanskrit. And this is a school that, you know, loves divisions. 25, I think, right? 25 divisions of things in the world. And, you know, as with the mind-only school, I'm not an expert on mind-only, and I'm not an expert on Sankhya at all. And so, you know, to really have these verses have much meaning, you know, you really have to know the systems that he's criticizing. And, you know, so if you wanted to spend a couple of years studying Sankhya, then you could come back to these verses and kind of get more out of them, probably. But I personally don't have that much time in my life to dedicate to Sankhya. So, the first couple of verses are about the premise that they have in the Sankhya system that everything in the world, everything physical manifest in the world can be reduced to what's called prakriti. Prakriti means nature. Here they call it pradana, the primal one. And then from the primal one comes three gunas, the three constituents of the world. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Sattva means purity or something like that. Rajas means activity, and Tamas, I usually translate nowadays as, sluggishness. Sluggishness, torpor, you know, kind of laziness and like that. So he's saying, like, if you say that the world is, that the world has some kind of nature because it's made up of three components, sattva, rajas, and tamas, then you're saying that one thing can have three self-natures. And one thing can't be three things at the same time. I bet you if he found out, if Shantideva had known about Christianity, he'd make the same argument. Because in Christianity, they say there's three in one, three in one. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three are all part of one. So that's his argument there. That's about like the first, I don't know, a couple of verses here into 130 or so. Then by 131 he says, if you argue that existing things are really just causes, then haven't you analyzed existing things away? This is in reference to a topic that he comes back to that we'll actually do sort of verse by verse. But in the Sankhya system, apparently, they argue that the result is inherent in the cause. That the sprout, it lies in potens, potential, in the seed. So that when the sprout comes from the seed, it just manifests something that's already there in the seed. And Shantideva doesn't like that at all, for reasons that you'll find out. For one thing, in these early verses here of this class, he says it contradicts our experience. It contradicts our experience of things. Our experience of causality is sequential. You know, there's a seed first, and then a sprout comes from that seed. The sprout and the seed can't exist at the same time. Cause and result can't exist at the same time. So then the next part is the impermanence of feelings. And in this section, he kind of returns to something that we talked about last night when everyone was like passing out, including me. And that is, if it's possible for a subtle form of feeling, like happiness, let's say, to exist while a gross form of unhappiness is being felt, can there be still a remnant of one kind of feeling while another kind of feeling has taken dominance? And he argues against that. It doesn't, and the basic argument as far as I can tell is that you can't call it a feeling unless you're feeling it. It's not a feeling. You can't say there's a subtle form of unhappiness when you're feeling happy unless you're also feeling the unhappiness. It doesn't make any sense to call it a feeling at all. And feelings can only happen one at a time. This is also the case with thought. You can't hold two ideas at the same time. I mean, you know, thoughts happen very, very quickly, but they happen one at a time. You can't hold two ideas in the mind at the same time. The only exception to that in Buddhist philosophy is bodhicitta, actually. Because bodhicitta, citta means a kind of a thought. But it's a real bodhicitta. I mean, the bodhicitta that has transformed you into a different kind of a being is a kind of a ongoing subconscious thought, a kind of an arena. It forms a kind of an arena or a room in which other thoughts can occur also. See, it perfumes all of the thoughts. But other than that, thoughts have to happen one at a time, and feelings have to happen one at a time. Okay? So I just saved us all a lot of trouble with these verses. Now we'll pick it up verse by verse under the heading number 3, valid perception. If the effect is present in the cause, so now he comes back to that idea apparently held by the Sankhya school, that the effect is potential. It exists as a potential in the cause. The sprout exists in a potential way in the seed. If the effect is present in the cause, then the eating of food would be the eating of excrement. What is the cause of excrement? food. So excrement is the result of eating food. So if the result was present in the cause, when you're eating food, you'd be eating your own shit. And for the price of cloth, you could buy cotton seeds and wear them. You get the idea, right? While the worldly do not perceive this. So now he's saying, like, you know, this doesn't make common sense. This is not commonsensical. The worldly don't perceive that the result is in the cause. You know, this is not the way that ordinary perception occurs. While the worldly do not perceive this, it is also the case that those who know how things really are don't either. If you analyze it, it makes no sense. So ordinary people, without any analyzation, would never say that the result is in the cause, potentially or otherwise. The result and the cause exist in the same phenomenon. And if you analyze it, it makes no sense either. Everyone in the world knows this. So why don't they see your point of view? He's talking to the Sankhya's now. And then if you say it's because the worldly lack valid perception, then even seeing things that are manifest must also be false. So here he's saying, like, well, you know, maybe they just don't see things validly when they don't see the result in the cause. But then even seeing things that are visible, apparent, then they must also be false because they don't have valid perception. And then the Sankhya guy comes back and says, if valid perception is invalid, then what is validated by it is false. Therefore, in reality, the emptiness of phenomena is impossible. So this is to say, how can emptiness be validated? How can your claim that things are empty be validated if there's no real, truly existing valid perception? And Shantideva in the next verse says something very important. If you don't apprehend an imaginary thing, you can't apprehend a non-existing thing. And so when an existing thing is thought of wrongly, its non-existence is also apprehended wrongly. So this is in reference to the fact that if we're going to get to the emptiness of anything, let's take the glasses, we first have to get in touch with how we imagine the glasses to exist. Right? So we have to apprehend an imaginary thing, as it says in the verse here. So how do we think glasses exist? Well, we think glasses exist as unchanging, as a whole, and as out there, independent. Okay? Unchanging. These glasses, I mean, you know, unchanging really just means not changing second by second, you know, not even second, right? Nanosecond by nanosecond. Of course, we all you know, anybody, normal people would agree that over time, you know, decades, centuries, this is going to change. But when they say a changing thing, they mean nanosecond by nanosecond change. So we first have to get in touch with our strong sense that this is not changing nanosecond by nanosecond. It's not too hard to get in touch with that because that's how we think about it all the time. It's not too hard to get in touch with the idea that I'm holding one pair of glasses. We say pair of glasses, right? One thing, right? One thing here. And not a set of multiple parts. It's not too hard to get in touch with that, right? And it's not too hard to, it's certainly not too hard to get in touch with our idea that if we all left the room, those glasses would still be there. That's an independently existing glasses. Doesn't depend on the perceiver of the glasses, right? So we first have to get in touch with this imaginary thing that we think is there. An unchanging, unitary, independent thing called glasses. Yep. You can't apprehend a non-existing thing. Without apprehending an imaginary thing, you can't apprehend what it it doesn't have. The non-existent thing here means kind of like the emptiness of the glass. The emptiness, the non-existence of permanence, okay, because it's a changing thing, so the permanence doesn't exist. The non-existence of a whole that doesn't depend on its parts, and the non-existence of a thing that would be there if we all left the room. So we first have to get in touch with the error in order to understand the emptiness of the thing. In Tibetan, they call this gakja, G-A-K-J-A, which is one of those Tibetan words that you can remember, you know, in English, because it sounds like English, gotcha. We've been had by our illusion about the glasses. So since an object doesn't exist, now we move to another part, okay? So when we analyze objects, we find that they are empty of being the way we imagined them to. So when an existing thing is thought of wrongly, its non-existence is also apprehended wrongly. So if we think that they are as they seem, then we will also misunderstand. Now he kind of moves to a different level of argument. He says, if we don't understand how they seem to exist, we can't understand their emptiness, their non-existence of existing the way they seem to exist. But then he moves to another kind of, this is another deeper level, okay? When we turn our mind on the emptiness of the glasses, then emptiness itself becomes an object of deceptive reality. Because it just is a concept, you know, just an idea. And the emptiness is also empty. So when we think about the absence of permanence, wholeness, unitariness, and independent existence of that, when we think about the absence, then our mind grasps on to absence. Oh, emptiness. I think it's black. It's all black there. Nothing's there. And then the next level of analysis is to say, and emptiness itself is empty, which means that it's not a thing in and of itself. And the absence of something is not something. Okay? The absence of something, emptiness, depends itself on the presence of something. Right? So this is very, I think, very tempting. When you study emptiness for a while and you start to think, well, okay, I'm starting to get it, then you start to grasp on to emptiness. Oh, we're the emptiness guys. We're the emptiness club. You know? Yay, emptiness. As if it were something, you see? And so there's what they call the emptiness of emptiness. The emptiness of emptiness. Emptiness itself depends on something that is empty. And something that is empty depends on emptiness to be what it is. A thing that's empty of changelessness, unitariness, and independent existence. So the next verse, this is under the general rubric. I created these rubrics, actually. So number 4, things have only dream-like existence. And so, when in a dream one's child is killed, one imagines he or she is no more. You're having a dream, you dream a horrible nightmare, and you think my son or daughter is killed and therefore does no longer exist. That which is mistakenly imagined, okay, because it's just a dream. My son and daughter is dead. That which is mistakenly imagined blocks the arising of the thought that he or she actually is alive. Okay? So you imagine that they are dead, and that precludes the idea that they're still alive. Okay? In a dream. He's talking about in a dream. So this, in reference to the verse right before it, means that that emptiness blocks the idea that something has true existence. When we think about its emptiness, actually he's saying non-existence. So when we think about the non-existence of the glasses that we thought were there, right? The non-existence of a permanent, unitary, independently existing glasses. It blocks our idea that there is an unchanging, unitary, independent thing out there. Okay? When we think that there is no unitary, independent, unchanging, unitary, independent glasses out there, we can't also think there is a unitary, unchanging, independent glasses. Okay? Blocks it. So that this is very similar to what he said earlier in the chapter, that, you know, as a ploy, as an exercise, you can start saying glasses don't exist. Things like glasses don't exist, in order to block the idea that they do exist in the way that we usually think about them. But then he's also saying, but then you move to the next level and say, the non-existence or the emptiness of the glasses doesn't exist either, independently of a glasses that seems to exist. So it's kind of a three-part process. Number one, you say, glasses exist. You know, as we, and you don't have to like exercise any kind of effort to do this. All you have to do is get in touch with how you ordinarily think of things. Glasses exist. The unchanging, unitary, independent thing exists. Then you say, can't exist. Does not exist. There is no unchanging, unitary, independent glasses here. And then you say, and the non-existence doesn't exist either. An absolute non-existence doesn't exist either. Because as we said before, non-existence and existence require each other. There's no meaning just to non-existence unless it's in relation to existence. And then you kind of approach the truth, actually. The glasses neither exist nor don't exist. They don't both exist and not exist, and they neither exist nor non-exist. And you know, you work that kind of out, and there's just nothing left. Okay, then you're freeform. Then you're just free falling. Then you've jumped off the cliff without the parachute. Good news is what? No ground. Nothing to fall, nothing to hurt yourself. Okay? You're free, in other words. Sometimes they talk about that, like they talk about nirvana or enlightenment or freedom as freedom from conceptual elaboration. And to say things don't exist is a conceptual elaboration. It's just another concept. Non-existence is another concept, just like existence. So things neither exist, nor non-exist, nor both exist and don't exist, or neither exist, or don't exist. Did I get them all? Therefore, through analysis, we see that there is nothing whatsoever that is without a cause, and nothing is contained within the condition, either separately or taking as a whole. So there's no effect within a cause. He's coming back to that, I think. There's no effect that lies within the cause or even within a collection of cause. Nothing comes from something else. Nothing stays the same. Nothing departs. This could be lifted right out of Nagarjuna too. Nothing arises, nothing stays for a while, and nothing goes away. It's all just dreamlike. If something, he'll explain why in a couple of verses here. So I'll just leave it at that for now. That which is created by magic, and that which is created by causes. Think about it. Where does it come from, and where does it go? That which is created by magic, like, you know, presto changeo. Well, where did that rabbit out of a hat? Okay, where the hell was that rabbit before the magician pulled it out of the hat? And where does it go when it puts it back in the hat? And he's saying causality is just like that. How do things come into existence? Where were they before they were in existence? And where do they go after they last for a while and depart? See, that which appears only when it comes into the presence of something else. So now he's talking about dependence here, or interdependency. That which appears only when it comes into the presence of something else, and does not appear when that something else does not exist. How can there be true existence in that which is artificial, like a reflection in a mirror? So you can't see a reflection. The reflection in the mirror comes into existence when there's a mirror, right? It depends on the mirror. So everything's like that. Everything depends on something else. And you could also say, and something else depends on it. That's interdependence, right? So the basic truism here is that if something depends on something else for its existence, which means that it does not exist without the presence of the something else that it depends on, then you can't say that that has any real existence at all. See, certainly not an independent existence, right? So it's like an illusion. It's like the rabbit out of the hat. The rabbit out of the hat depends on the magician's trickery. It's not a real rabbit in the hat that he pulls out. It's a trick, some kind of trick, right? So too, that's the case with anything. If something exists, what need is there for a cause? Okay, if you say, well, glasses exist, then why talk about the causes of glasses? They're already there. What do they need causes for? You see? Right? If something exists, it doesn't need causes. He's talking about truly existing here, okay? Truly, not existing as in a dream, but existing really. So if you say something exists really, then what need is there for a cause? Then the next shoe to drop. And if something doesn't exist, if something's non-existent, what need is there for a cause? It's non-existent. And, he says quite clearly in the next verse, even with 10 million causes, you can't transform a non-existing thing into an existing thing. Why? It doesn't exist. Right? That's what it means. It doesn't exist. So you can bring all kinds of causes to a non-existing thing, and you're not going to make it an existing thing, because why? It doesn't exist. See, he's talking about how we think of things. We think that there are things that come into existence. Right? The glasses on the basis of their causes, All the causes and conditions come into place, and then glasses come into existence. So that's impossible. If the glasses exist, they never did not exist, because they're an existing thing. And if the glasses don't exist, then how can you make them exist? They're a non-existing thing. Even with 10 million causes, you can't transform a non-existing thing into an existing thing. How could something like that, a non-existing thing, become an existing thing? Talk about magic. That'd be the ultimate magic. To make something that does not exist exist. These are mutually exclusive things, right? They're like hot and cold, or up and down. Non-existent and existent are mutually exclusive. Has to be one or the other, right? And one can't turn into the other, because the hot doesn't actually become cold. It's either hot or cold. Up doesn't somehow turn into down. It's either one or the other, non-existent or existent. And what else is there that could become an existing thing except for a non-existing thing? So if you're saying that existing things come into existence, then they must come from a non-existing thing. Right? Because if they come from an existing thing, well, then they're already there. Oh, good. Not so hard today, huh? Wonder, the wonders of a good night's sleep.
Yes.
Mm. If no existing thing exists at the time when it is non-existent. Okay, so imagine, let's imagine that non-existing things come into existence somehow. A non-existent thing is not an existing thing. No existing thing exists at the time when it's non-existent, right? It's not there, nothing there. When would it become an existing thing? At what point would the leopard change spots? Would the tiger change stripes? It's one thing. It's a non-existing thing, which means no thing. It's no. At what time in its no-thingness, non-existence, would it somehow like all of a sudden become an existing? The opposite of that. The non-existing thing will not disappear if the existing thing is not brought into existence. So if you're imagining that an existing thing could come into being from a non-existing thing, then the non-existing thing would have to disappear for there to be an existing thing. Is it like magic? Just like it would have to be like magic. So it is like magic. Therefore, it can't be the way we think it is. We in ordinary like life think that non-existing things come into existence all the time, don't we? And that existing things go out of existence all the time. So we believe in the dream. We believe in the reality of what can only just be like a magic trick. Only like a dream, maya, only like illusion, only like a reflection in the mirror. Sometimes they also throw in like a city of ghosts, Gandharvas, like a city of imaginary beings, a ghost town. It's just the appearance. But we buy into the appearance and we think that things could exist in impossible ways or not exist in impossible ways. See? So we analyze it. It's impossible logically that things exist the way we think they do ordinarily. They do come. So, you know, again, of course we think that things come into existence all the time. They're not there, then they're there, and then they're not there again. Right? But that's just the dream. Just like in a dream. All kinds of stuff pops up in a dream, like, right? From nowhere. And that's the only way it can really be here, too. It can't really be happening. It can only appear to be happening. And if a non-existent thing has not disappeared, see, it can't be existing and non-existing at the same time. So if an existing thing comes from a non-existing thing, the non-existing thing would have to disappear, you would say. Because otherwise, if a non-existing thing has not disappeared, there's no possibility of an existing thing taking its place. It has to be one or the other. An existing thing does not become a non-existing thing, for it would follow that it could have two different natures. So the same thing can't be both non-existent and existent at the same time. It can't be two things at once. Thus, there is never any cessation or any becoming. Now he's starting to cash it out here. You know, this is a typical sort of, Buddhist kind of understanding of reality. Things arise, they last for a while, and then they stop. They come into cessation. They end. And he says, this is impossible. Shanti is impossible. There is never a cessation nor any becoming. No cessation, no end or no beginning. No end or no beginning. Here's a way to kind of get your head around that. When was the moment that you entered this room? Everyone came into this room, right? After lunch, right? When was it? Let's say it was 12:15 on the dot. 12:15. So 12:15 and how many seconds? 12:15 and how many seconds? So it's 12:15 and 30 seconds. 12:15 and 30 seconds after 12:15, 30 seconds after 12:15, I walked into the room. How many tenths of a second? Well, it was 12:15 and, what did I say, 20 seconds? 30 seconds and 6 tenths of a second. Well, how many hundredths of a second? See, and down you go. You could have never entered the room the way you think. No one entered the room the way they thought they did. It's impossible. Because if we entered the room at a particular moment, we should be able to identify that moment And every moment is divisible, further divisible into its parts. Every fraction of a moment is further divisible into its parts. So there's no time that you entered the room. There's only the appearance that you entered the room in a dreamlike fashion. We're living a dream. Thus there is never any cessation nor beginning. Therefore this whole world is neither produced nor does it cease. No beginning and no end, really, to anything. Only in a dreamlike fashion. Not really. States of existence are like dreams. Think I just made up that dream thing? States of existence are like dreams. Upon analysis, they're the same as a... Did I translate it plantain or banana?
Banana.
Aren't they the same, banana and plantain? Or, yeah. Same family or something. Yeah. They're just like that banana tree. Which is what? Hollow in the middle, right? In reality, there's no difference between those in nirvana and those who aren't. So he like just throws in these like cash outs every once in a while. Samsara and nirvana are not two different places. They're not two different truly existing states. They are two perspectives on the same thing. I always like to think about when you go to the eye doctor. I've always had bad eyes, so you know, I've been to the eye doctor a lot, and they have these, like, I don't know if they still do nowadays, they're like more fancy, I think, but they used to have these big machines that they put on your eyes, and then they go, which is better, this or that, this A or B, right? And they try different lenses on you, right? We're in the samsara lens. All we need to do is go like that, and we're in the nirvana lens. You don't have to get in a spaceship and go somewhere else. You don't have to like find some secret opening in reality and go through the door. All you need to do is see this reality differently. See? It's not, nothing needs to change. Nothing can change. Nothing needs to change. Only the perspective. So nirvana and samsara are the same thing. That sometimes they say it like quite baldly like that, starkly like that. That there's no difference whatsoever between nirvana and samsara. Meaning no outer difference, no external difference, just perspective. This is very good news, right? Because if nirvana was something that you had to find, where the hell is it? You know what I mean? Like, I've been to a lot of places in the world and I didn't see it anywhere. But if it's just a matter of perspective, changing your perspective, then nirvana could be, nirvana is a potential here and now. Nirvana is never attained then and there. It's only here and now. Always. Okay? And the same is with samsara. Samsara and nirvana, you could say, are a kind of illusions in a way. They're not real. Nirvana has no more reality than samsara does. It's just a different perspective on the dream. It's all dreamlike. But some people are taken in by the dream. That's samsara. Samsara is being taken in by the dream. And when you become lucid about the dream, that is nirvana. Okay? There's no difference between those in nirvana and those who aren't. So now the next verses are about the benefits of really trying to understand emptiness. And it's very interesting. I'll just give you a foretaste. He ends with compassion. But before that, he talks about these other things. He talks about equanimity, which we'll come back to in the afternoon class on the Four Immeasurables. Thus, when everything is empty, when all things, dharmas, are sunyata, all existing things are empty, what is there to gain or lose? You know. Why are we stressed out? Who is there to be honored or vilified? If the self is empty, then no one can really praise me or honor me, and no one can criticize me either, because there's no me. There's no me to criticize. If everything is empty, then you can just relax about everything, actually. Nothing can touch you. Nothing can hurt you, because there's no you to hurt. And there's nothing there to hurt you. It's all just imaginary. It functions because of our ignorance. It functions to hurt us. because we are ignorant and think that there's someone there to get hurt, and there's someone there hurting, you see? We buy into the dream. Then, thus, when everything is empty, what is there to gain or lose? Who is there to be honored or vilified? And by whom? Who's going to praise me? Who is it? There's nobody out there, really. Where do happiness and suffering come from? They don't come from outside of you, right? There's nothing outside of you that can bring you happiness or suffering, either one. What is there that is likable or dislikable? Things don't have likability or dislikability in them. We project it onto them, right? Even such things as, like, Javanese coffee is not likable from its own side. What? Everyone's heard this probably in this room. It's heard the argument for what? It's a very simple argument for that. Why? Not everyone likes it. Not everyone likes it. That's one argument. The other argument is, if you drink 13 cups of Javanese coffee, you're not going to like it either. If it had likability in it, the more you drank, the more likable you'd find it. Right? Stay the same, at least. It'll always be likable. Yeah. If you like ice cream, is the likability in the ice cream? No, it can't be, right? It can't be. Try it. Try eating a gallon of ice cream. I mean, you know, if you have a couple of spoonfuls, it tastes good. By the end of the first pint, it's starting to not taste so good. By the time you get through four pints in a gallon, you're sick as a dog. So it can't be in the ice cream, right? What is there that is likable or dislikable? When we look for their self natures, what is craving, and for what is there craving? Both the feeling of craving and the object for which you crave are both illusory. You can't find them when you go look for them. So they don't have that kind of the kind of real existence that we think they do. Desire and the objects of desire don't truly exist. Here's another way of thinking about that, okay? You know, never mind the ice cream and stuff. Which comes first? The desirer, the one who desires, one who has desire, or the object for which that one has desire? Neither can possibly come first, right? You can't just sit around going, I desire. You have to desire something. Right? You desire a desirable object. But the desirable object isn't a desirable object until and unless someone desires it. It's not sitting out there going, I'm desirable. You know, big red lights flashing, a billboard or something like that. Right? It becomes desirable when it is desired. And the desirer, the one who desires, has desire when they desire an object of desire. A desirable object. Neither can exist without the other. The whole chapter I just summarized the whole chapter in Nagarjuna for you. He's got a whole chapter on the desirer and the object of desire. It's impossible. So desire doesn't really exist. Doesn't really exist means does not exist independently. Does not exist with its own self nature as desire. Okay? It requires an object of desire. And the object of desire doesn't exist as an object of desire with any kind of self-nature either. It becomes an object of desire when linked in a relationship of interdependence. And only, see, only. So where is it? What is there that is likable or dislikable? When we look for their self-natures, what is craving? And for what is there? And for what is there craving? Upon analysis, what is this world of living beings? You know, it's going to really pan out. It's like talk about the whole shebang here, the whole deal. Who really dies here? Very similar to the Bhagavad Gita, actually. I've just been teaching the Bhagavad Gita recently. And, you know, Krishna goes on. The first thing that Krishna says to Arjuna, when Arjuna is like, you know, teach me, he says, it's all just an illusion. Chill out already. Nobody kills, nobody dies, it's all just a kind of a play. And, you know, that's not good enough for Arjuna, it's probably not good enough for us either. But it's true. It's all, it isn't happening the way we think it is. Upon analysis, what is this world of living beings? Who really dies here? Who will come into existence? Who's going to be born? And who has already come into existence? Who are us? Who are we? We're in existence in between birth and death, and who are we? Who is a relative? Who is a friend to whom? All just like a dream. So then the last bit here, okay? Emptiness and compassion. Very interesting that he ends the whole ninth chapter like this. Because emptiness can be kind of dry. You know, wisdom can be in the wrong hands, like most of us, most of our hands, can just get kind of like sterile, intellectually sterile. No heart in it. So Shantideva brings the heart back here now. May those who are like me understand that everything is like empty space. Empty space is an often used metaphor for emptiness. They always say like empty space because it's not empty space. But it's like, why isn't emptiness like, why isn't emptiness empty space? Empty space is the condition of possibility for there to be appearances, right? Without empty space, there'd be no place for anything. Okay? So in a way, you could say emptiness is the condition of possibility for appearances as they exist. They are empty of existing in an unchanging, unitary, independent way. And because they are empty, because there's that space, they can exist in a changing, multiple, and interdependent way. So emptiness makes possible form. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, like that, right? So why isn't emptiness and empty space the same thing? Empty space refers only to physical things. And there's another whole bit to us. This is what? Mental things. See, mental things. Mental things don't happen in empty space. Okay? They don't need empty space to, they're not physical. So there's the emptiness of things and there's the emptiness of mind. There's emptiness of physical things, material things, and there's emptiness of mental things. So to say it's like empty space just gives us something to put our minds on because it's kind of relatively easy to get a hold of the idea of empty space because it's out there. But it's also the case in here too. There's nothing in here that's not empty either. No thinker without a thought. Okay? There's no thinker sitting around going, I'm a thinker, but I'm not thinking anything. You see? That would be an independently existing thinker. The thinker depends on the thought to be a thinker. The thought depends on the thinker to be a thought. Neither can exist without the other. Neither can come first. Okay? So there's no mind. No mind. To say a mind, it reifies it, makes it into a thing somehow. There's no mind. What we call the mind is one half of a function. It's all just function, you could say. All just a process. All just function. There's no mind that thinks. There's a thinker who thinks when the thinker thinks a thought. And not until. And the thought, of course, they're not free-floating thoughts around there, you know, without a thinker to them. Without a thinker thinking them. Everything exists in exactly the same way. May those who are like me understand that everything is like empty space. So may those who are like me. I looked it up. He starts the whole book in the first chapter with a similar statement. He says, I'm writing this down in order to help me purify my own mind. It's really just for me that I'm doing this whole book. And then he says, and if there's others who are like me who benefit from it, great. Yeah. So those who are like me, may those who are like me understand that everything is like empty space. Others, now he's talking about suffering sentient beings. Others become enraged by quarrels and are elated when there are festivals. Seeking happiness only for themselves, they do bad things and live with great difficulty, with grief and troubles, depression, cutting and stabbing each other. After repeated good births in which they become accustomed to pleasure, the deceased fall into bad states where the pain is intense and long-lasting. You know, we get used to it. We get used to the idea that the kind of life that we lead now is the kind of life we will always lead. Even in this life, that's not guaranteed at all. Okay? It can change, like, suddenly, overnight. You know, if the economy doesn't tank, if your own personal economy doesn't tank, maybe the whole economy will tank. If your, you know, if your personal health doesn't go, which it will, you know, all of a sudden you're in the middle of a war zone. There are people living now in the middle of a war zone. And, you know, their lives have suddenly changed. You know, maybe when they were 20 or 30 years ago, they were living lives pretty much like us in, you know, places like Lebanon. And now all completely different. And then that's the case, you know, according to the text, over lifetimes too. You get used to one thing, and then next lifetime, because you haven't created the causes and conditions to keep it going, then you have a very different experience in the next lifetime. You know, I read a lot about all these hell realms and stuff like that, and you know, according to the, you know, traditional Buddhism, they're supposed to be real places. But you don't have to, like, imagine, you know, new zones of existence to find hell realms, right? They're right here. You know, if you want to look at a hell realm, just go to, like I said, a war zone. Or I had the experience once of going into the emergency room in New York City over a weekend, a public hospital. And that was pretty much of a war zone, too. They were bringing in all the gunshot victims and all of that, you know, the weekend. And it's just chaos. You could just find yourself in chaos, like all of a sudden. And then all bets are off. After repeated good births in which they become accustomed to pleasure, the deceased fall into bad states where their pain is intense and long-lasting. There are many pitfalls in world existence. There's many ways that we can screw it up here. Nothing like how things really are is found there for people who, you know, don't see it that way. There is only conflict with one another here, there. In worldly existence, there is nothing like how things really are. He says it twice. There's no tattva. There's no reality in the ordinary understandings of existence, worldly existence. And there are boundless oceans of incomparable and intense suffering. There is thus not much strength and very short lifespans. Because we live under these conditions in samsara, you know, we get tired easily, you know. It's tiring to have to, like, deal with suffering all the time. You know, even people living, like, in the bubble, like us, in some kind of protected bubble, you know, we still have plenty of problems, right? And it's tiring. When you have to confront problems all the time, then it's hard to find the time and the mental space to actually get serious about how reality must really exist, you know, to take the time to do a retreat like this and to really kind of delve deeply, because we're constantly bombarded with all of these things, problems and things that have to be taken care of and all of that. At very short lifespans, comparatively. You know, you might think, well, I'm going to be 80 or something like that. It's a pretty good lifespan, but 80 years go by pretty quick. I know 60 have, you know. And so relatively, it's very short lifespans. There too, people are just preoccupied with staying alive and healthy, and life is characterized by hunger, fatigue, weariness, exhaustion, sleep, calamities, and unprofitable associations with fools. Life passes by quickly, and people live in vain. Discrimination, viveka, discrimination is difficult to obtain there. You know, one kind of summary of what viveka means, discrimination, is knowing what to take up and knowing what to give up. Knowing what's important to do and what's not important to do. Prioritization, that's discrimination in one form. Discrimination is difficult to obtain there. How could there be a way to prevent habitual distractions in such a place? There are also Mara, you know who Mara is, the kind of like demon, casts people into great misfortunes, and there, because of the multitude of false paths, doubt is difficult to conquer. This is especially true, I think, in our day and age, because we're exposed to all kinds of, you know, philosophies and ways of life and so forth, all kinds of them, and perhaps most importantly and most liable to keep us distracted and in doubt when it comes to our spiritual life is the secular worldview that has now dominated the world. And by that I mean not just a kind of a non-spiritual worldview, but the worldview of consumerism. Consumer capitalism won globally. There's no alternative. There used to be communism and capitalism. I wonder if China, communist country, has gotten consumerist at all. The consumerist ideology has taken hold everywhere. Everywhere. No matter what the organization of the government is, the ideology, the way of thinking, is globally consumerism. And that's a big power to fight when it comes to a spiritual life, because a spiritual life is kind of the opposite of consumerism in a way. It's the belief that it's not through individual consumption and buying that you can be happy. It's kind of like the opposite of that. Happiness doesn't come from these things. So multitude of false paths. Such an opportunity is difficult to obtain again. Always says that. Life like this is hard to get. And the appearance of a Buddha is extremely difficult to obtain. The torrent of mental afflictions is hard to keep at bay. Oh, what a parade of suffering. Alas, the condition of those drowning in this flood of suffering is so lamentable. Even though they are in very bad shape, they don't even perceive it. Like people who repeatedly douse themselves, you know, means take a shower or something like that, who repeatedly douse themselves only to be again and again thrown into the fire. They are in a very bad situation, but regard themselves as living in an auspicious condition. You know, not just them, we also don't even know how bad off we are. You know, because we get some temporary pleasure or something like that, and we don't recognize that we are liable to great suffering at any time. Great suffering. We forget. Going about their business like this, pretending that they are immune from old age and death. Young people feel like they're immune from old age. I remember feeling that. Like, you know. I think sometimes young people get this romantic idea that they'll die heroically before they get old, you know, and then that doesn't work out. So people think they're immune from old age until they become old, and then they think they're immune from death until they die, and then all of a sudden, oh, how could this have happened? Oh my goodness, I'm dying. How could this have happened? When might I relieve those tormented by the fire of suffering, utilizing, how did I translate this? I've got it all.
Utilizing different. The instruments coming from the clouds of merit.
Yeah. Yeah. How might I relieve those tormented and bring them, punya mega, punya merit, the clouds of merit, beautiful expression actually, that will rain down, you know, blessings and help to all beings. This is the end of the ninth chapter. Very interesting way to end it, isn't it? Last verse. When will I effectively teach emptiness and the accumulation of merit? Punya sambara. The accumulation of merit is what brings you the form body of a Buddha. When will I effectively teach emptiness, which would bring you the wisdom body, the truth body of a Buddha, and then the accumulation of merit that comes from non-attachment to deceptive reality? To those who are attached to their views. Very beautiful way of ending a heavy-duty chapter on emptiness. It reminds me, it reminded me, because, you know, he ends this attachment to drishti, to viewpoints. It reminds me of the way that Nagarjuna ends the Root Verses on the Middle Way, his great masterpiece on emptiness. This is from the 27th chapter, last verse, 30th verse, last verse of the whole text. I bow down to him, to Gautama, to the Buddha, who out of compassion taught the true Dharma, Sat Dharma, the real Dharma, in order to bring about the abandoning of all viewpoints. The abandoning of all drishtis. Drishti means point of view or worldview, you could say. And that's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal isn't to grasp on to a better world. I mean, you know, it's good to grasp on to a better worldview than a bad worldview. But the ultimate goal is to not grasp on to any worldview and to be free of conceptual elaboration. To free yourself from your own mind. To free yourself from your own mind and the demands that your own mind constantly makes. What's true? What's false? What's right? What's wrong? Who's better? Who's worse? You see, drishtis, points of view. Point of view, the purpose of a spiritual life is not to be good, it's not to be right, it's to be free. Better to be good than bad. You know, but it's to be free of all points of view. So I love the way that these great masters end you know, brilliant presentations by saying, like, you know, be free even of the worldview that you think I'm espousing. You know, Nagarjuna says it quite clearly. Nagarjuna says, I don't have any point of view. I don't have any drishti. I'm not teaching a worldview. I'm teaching the insufficiency of any worldview. That's what emptiness really means. The insufficiency to grasp ultimate reality with any words, with any philosophical doctrines or something like that. They're all wrong in a way. They're all distorted in a way. So that's another way to, like, feel a little bit relaxed as we end the ninth chapter here. Is that, okay, so we don't understand everything that Shantideva is saying in the ninth chapter. But that's okay, because the buddhi is deceptive. He says that, right? The intellect will never really grasp it. You see? So we do our best. We do our best to understand it with the intellect, with the understanding that the purpose of understanding it with the intellect is to learn how to let go of the intellect. And to recognize the limitations of the mind, and not to grasp onto them as if you now finally got the right answer. There is no right answer. There is no ultimately right answer. The only right answer is the absence of all answers. That's what they mean by, you know, attached to your drishti, attached to the idea that there is a right answer. And then you can, like, go to war with all the people who don't have the right answer. And quarrel with them, like, just like in this description he had of, like, what samsaric life like is like. You just, like, hassle with each other all the time. Who's right, who's wrong, who's better, who's worse, you know. Which ology or ism is correct and which one isn't. And it's a very wonderful thing that there are texts like this in the world. Which teach us that, you know, that the ultimate truth does not exist in texts like this in the world. That the ultimate truth is beyond language, beyond concept, beyond belief, beyond isms and ologies. And that's the way to point to freedom. That's pointing to freedom. Using the drishti to overcome the drishti. Using the tenets and the doctrines and, you know, the ninth chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life to get to the precipice, to the edge of the cliff. But you have to jump off. Okay, that's freedom. Jumping up and down on the edge of the cliff is not freedom. Waving your banner and saying, yay, emptiness, or yay, Mahayana Buddhism, or, yeah? But jumping off. All right, thank you very much for listening. This is a great privilege for me to be able to teach this particular chapter also, and I learned a lot preparing for it, and so thank you for providing the occasion for me to learn. Yeah, exercise four. What is it, Sue? Exercise for class four. Reviewing the arguments about the dreamlike existence. You know, the statements in the text that say that samsara only has a dreamlike existence and that causation cannot work the way we think it does. And to, you know, kind of review that and think about it. What kind of causation occurs in our experience of dreaming? That's an interesting kind of thing to think about. Like, what causes what in a dream? Yeah. Okay. So we'll take a break now and have lunch and a little relaxation, and then we can meet again at 3:30 here for this just little kind of nice, easy ceremony. Okay?